ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। What verse is it? Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 11, Chapter 21, Text Number 16. Kvachit kano pi dhosha syad, dosho pi hirana gunam, guno dosata nihamas, tadvidam eva badvate, kvachit kano pi dhosha syad, dosho pi hirana gunam, guna dosata nihamas, tadvidam eva badvate, kvachit kano pi dhosha syad, dosho pi vidana guna, guna dosata niyamas, tadvidam eva bhadate, kvachit, sometimes, gunaha, piety, api, even, doshaha, sin, shat, becomes, doshaha, sin, api, also, vidina, on the strength of Vedic injunction, gunaha, piety, guna dosha, to piety and sin, atta, regard, regarding, niyamaha, restrictive regulation, tat, of them, vidham, the distinction, eva, actually, bhadate, and does. 100. Translation. Sometimes piety becomes sin, and sometimes what is ordinarily sin becomes piety on the strength of Vedic injunctions. Such special rules, in effect, eradicate the clear distinction between piety and sin. Purport. The Lord clearly explains here that material piety and sin are always relative considerations. For example, if a neighbor's house is on fire and one chops a hole in the roof so that the trapped family may escape, one is considered to be a pious hero because of the dangerous condition. In normal conditions, however, if one chops a hole in his neighbor's roof or breaks the neighbor's windows, he is considered a criminal. Similarly, one who abandons one's wife and children is certainly irresponsible and thoughtless. If one takes sannyas, however, and remains fixed on a higher spiritual platform, he is considered to be a most saintly person. Piety and sin, therefore, depend upon particular circumstances and are at times difficult to distinguish. According to Srila Madhvacharya, persons above the age of 14 are considered capable of distinguishing between good and bad, and are thus responsible for their pious and sinful activities. Animals, on the other hand, being merged in ignorance, cannot be blamed for their offences or praised for their so-called good qualities, which all arise ultimately from ignorance. Human beings who act like animals, with the idea that one should not feel any guilt but should do whatever one likes, will certainly take birth as animals absorbed in ignorance. And there are other foolish people who, observing the relativity of material piety and sin, conclude that there is no absolute good. It should be understood, however, that Krishna consciousness is absolutely good because it involves complete obedience to the Absolute Truth, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, whose goodness is eternal and absolute. Those who are inclined to study material piety and sin ultimately experience frustration due to the relativity and variability of the subject matter. One should therefore come to the transcendental platform of Krishna consciousness, which is valid and perfect in all circumstances. Kachit guno pi dosha sat dosha pi vidana gunam guno dosata niyam yas tad vidam eva baddhate. Sometimes piety becomes sin, and sometimes what is ordinarily sin becomes piety on the strength of Vedic injunctions. Such special rules in effect eradicate the clear distinction between piety and sin. So, very interesting, very important verse really, that especially for those who try to legislate what is good and bad, what is acceptable within society and what is not acceptable. Practically speaking, they have almost an impossible job. Of course, if we follow the Vedic system, although it is very, very intricate, as Krishna describes in the Bhagavad Gita, that very, very intelligent persons, great saintly minded persons, they become a little bewildered trying to understand the distinctions between what is action or authorized activities, what is unauthorized activities, and what is inaction. Action which has no reaction. So Krishna describes this is a very, very difficult subject matter even for the topmost intelligent persons. So if you take the greatest minds on this planet today, if you took, say 100 of the best, greatest thinkers, and you got them together in their committee room or council room, council chambers, and got them to try to work out legislation as what is acceptable in society and what is not, they would actually fail to do that. Even those who follow Vedic injunctions would find it very difficult, but still, at least, if they know the Vedas very well, everything is there. What is proper for all different levels, all different people, for women, for children, for brahmanas, kshatriyas, vaishyas, sudras, even those who live in the jungle or primitive persons. The Vedas set out what is proper and what is improper, And then there are special circumstances where the rules change a little. In other words, what's ordinarily a good activity under special circumstances then becomes something which is forbidden. And under certain circumstances, what is ordinarily a forbidden activity becomes acceptable. In fact, necessary. And even that activity, which was previously forbidden, one can become highly, credited and recognized and awarded for that activity. Just like killing. Ordinarily, we cannot, in the Vedic society, you cannot kill, but in certain circumstances you can kill. If someone tries to steal your wife, if someone tries to burn down your house, someone tries to kill you, or attack you, poison you. There's some others. What's that? Someone tries to take your land, your property. So, according to the Vedic conception, those aggressors can immediately be killed. That's not to say that the person who is being attacked or usurped, that that person themselves should do the killing. That's left up to the Kshatriyas, or those who are actually administrating the law. So in other words, in Vedic civilization, if someone came and tried to steal one's wife, one could actually go to the rulers and petition and complain, this person has done this, and then the Kshatriyas will come with their sword and they'll say, yes, let's chop off his head. But it's not that the Brahmas, just anyone would, he's an aggressor, let's kill him, like this. So, in that case, we see that generally. But even the rulers, if they kill for no reason, I think Bhaina, King Bhaina used to do that, used to enjoy killing. Then they can actually be removed by the Brahmanas. but sometimes eating killing is considered very good, very pious, very wonderful, and other times the same act by the same person under different circumstances, no matter how elevated that person is, that act becomes very much condemned. Similarly, non-violence is also generally taken as a pious activity. But in some circumstances, non-violence is very much condemned as an impious activity. So we see that actually Gandhi had his non-violent movement, Ahimsa, and he was once asked that if someone came to rape your daughter in front of you, would you use violence? And he said, no. So that is abominable. As an example of even violence, non-violence becoming an atrocious, impious activity. So sometimes, under certain circumstances, one activity is very pious, and under certain circumstances, the same activity is impious. So it's very difficult sometimes to ascertain, but the special conditions are stated in the Vedas. Excuse me. But ultimately, it is so because all considerations of piety and impiety are based upon relative conditions. In material piety and material impiety are based upon relative conditions, and therefore it is extremely frustrating trying to deal in the material world. So you make a law and you make all sorts of special conditions, and then you'll find something comes up that just doesn't fit into even your special conditions, but it's not there in the law. So therefore what happens, of course, is the governments, the police force, those who are enforcing the law, they just literally have to enact a law. Everyone considers, oh, this is wrong. You know, we are, only these laws we have, and yet if we enforce these laws, here is an innocent person who will be, treated very unjustly by our judicial system. But they have no choice. They must enact a law. So it becomes very, very difficult, very, very frustrating, both for the legislators and, of course, for people in general. And in Kali Yuga, now, generally, of course, when the majority of people are acting piously, and there's some common sense and people are following the Vedic laws, which have, provisions for most things, it is difficult in itself. But what to speak of Kali Yuga, where everyone is sinful. The only distinction really between a pious person and an impious person is the suit that they wear. The suit, what clothes they wear. So they're all acting sinfully, but some dress as if they're, very law-abiding citizens, and some don't. But it becomes very difficult. Everyone in Kali Yuga is, to one degree or another, acting impiously. In Kali Yuga, people don't know what pious activities is. It's very difficult to act piously if you don't know what a pious activity is. And just like previously, it was a pious, or a father and mother would perform their duty towards their daughters if they had them, married. In Vedic culture, the young girls were married quite young, usually by about the age of 12. Even, Prabhupada, I think he had three sisters, and they were married between 9 and 12 years old. Each generation, of course, it changes. He was saying that his daughter, she was married at 16. But he remembers his mother saying, because one of his sisters was coming to the age of 12, And his mother was saying to the Prabhupada's father that if you don't get her married soon, I will jump in the river and commit suicide. and the father was, yes, I am trying, like this. So it was considered very impious, to neglect one's daughters and not get them a very, very nice husband. And as Srila Prabhupada pointed out, of course, that for a young girl at that age, even though they didn't live with the husband, they're married at 12 or whatever, they're not living with the husband for some time. But because they have this understanding, yes, I have a husband, for a young girl, she feels very, very secure and very, very happy and very, very fulfilled in life. That is the nature. And because they are married at such a young age, of course, there's a natural lifelong attraction, loving relationship that grows between themselves and the husband. And then, of course, at an early age, they have children. Prabhupada's wife was... he married his wife when she was 11, and she gave birth to her first child when she was 14. So, that was the Vedic, even up to, Prabhupada's time, that was the Vedic time. Of course, now, the parents, not only they make no arrangement, of course, the children usually won't let them make any arrangement, they won't let them parents help in any different way, but unfortunately a lot of young girls are allowed to be even abused, by their parents in different ways. So the standard of generally, a lot of young girls leave home at about 15 or 16 because they can't see, they're not deriving any benefit. They can't see that they're deriving any benefit at home. And sometimes, it can be very oppressive or very disturbing, home life. So a lot of, these days, very common for young girls to, just leave home unmarried, sometimes not even fully educated, and just to go out because they know that they're either not going to get any help from the parents, or the help that they're going to get from their parents is not going to be very substantial. So we see that even the most basic activities between a father and a daughter. In Kali Yuga, even that is not there. What to speak of anything else? Even the most basic activities of, providing for one's, sons and daughters and, husband and wife, their activities together, looking after each other. Even the most essential elements in Kali Yuga are not there. People are very sinful. Most married couples these days, of course, it's very common to have, extramarital affairs. In fact, the statistics by those who run the different sex shops and sex trade, and what have you, whether it be prostitution or, they have their different paraphernalia and what have you, their main clients... 80 to 90% of the main clients are married people, middle class, Christian, or but the average person, the average married couple, they are the main clients for most of the, you know, sex trade and what have you. And the same, they have the, if you go through a lot of the local papers, not that you should, but you see advertised for, you know, people want, you know, someone to come and join their twosome or threesome and wife swapping and so many things. But again, most of the, and a lot of people are, you know, looking for a good time, looking for a nice partner. Most of the people placing those ads are not single people. They're married people. Like this. So, just, you know, in Kali Yuga, we're talking about piety and impiety. In Kali Yuga, it becomes so difficult. Just like now, there's a debate that... who's that famous golfer? Tiger Woods. So, I think the last count was, you know, his extramarital affairs were somewhere over 100. But, still, he's recognised as a very great man, a good man, because he's a good sportsman. Well, he can't play football. He can't play volleyball. He's not a very good swimmer. Actually, he's not really a good swimmer, a sportsman, but he can play one sport, which he does okay. Of course, you know, when there's a couple of $1 million in the pot, you know, up for takings, you bet you're going to swing that, you know, golf club as nice as you can. But so the debate is that they want the taxpayers to fork out, you know, so many millions of dollars for him to come again for the next, you know, big golf tournament. So they want the average taxpayers to pay for him to, you know, it comes into millions because he's a very expensive person, to pay for his tour because it has this great benefit to the golfing industry, and therefore Victoria makes a lot of money, and therefore ultimately the whole thing is considered a pious activity because it's good. So therefore, to, you know, spend millions of dollars on, you know, a whoremonger is now a pious activity which is sanctioned by the government. So so, but you know, the list could go on and on. Of course, you could, you know, fill many hours talking about the. But just, you know, to give the point, it's very, very difficult in Kali Yuga. People have no idea anymore what is good and bad, and it is and therefore, the result is, as described here, that when people can no longer distinguish, even with great difficulty, what is good and what is bad, because the people who are saying this is good, you know, they're the biggest rascals. And people who are saying, you know, that something is bad, they're being condemned. You know, so people just you know, cannot. If you stand up for anti-abortion, reduce intoxication, reduce the slaughterhouses, you'll be condemned as a madman. You know, a troubling element to society, antisocial, a rogue, like this. And very easily you can get thrown into jail. I remember, you know, in the early days of doing Sankirtan, we were in a town of, in Bathurst, up in New South Wales, at the back of New South Wales. So this was probably very early 80s. Maybe 1982 or something. And we were selling candles. So of course there's many door-to-door salesmen, even in the 80s. It's not that, you know, the Hare Krishnas were the only door-to-door salesmen. But of course we were probably the most successful door-to-door salesmen. But they people considered it impious to give a Hare Krishna money. That's a fact. There's some do. So it was just a it was understood by the government and by the people in general that you do not give the Hare Krishna money. So therefore it was condoned upon. So I was actually selling candles in a supermarket, and I had all the checkout chicks that all gathered up, and they were all buying profusely, even a few of the customers. So I had, you know, a couple of boxes of candles, and I'd probably, you know, done quite well, a couple of $100. Anyway, there's about 4 policemen walked in, and you know, said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm just, you know, selling some candles." And I said, "You know," so they said, "No, this is you can't do this." And I said, "Well, I'm just selling candles. They're buying them." So what they, I tried to explain. So they literally just lifted me off the ground. You know, they had one under each arm. The others grabbed all the money, you know, hundreds of dollars, probably about 300, I think, and all the candles. And they just lifted us, myself, carried me out to the paddy wagon, and threw me in the back. And then later drove around and they grabbed my partner and grabbed him as well and tucked him into the back of the car. So then we went to court. So first of all, because they really wanted us to suffer a little bit, so they thought rather than just put them in the lockup, we'll put them in the prison. So all the hardened crimson and that. So my Sankirtan partner, in the Shunya Prashad, he's going, "Whatever you do, when you get to prison, don't say anything. Don't speak to anyone." Because he didn't follow his own advice, because he made the mistake of trying to, you know, defend himself or, you know, speak out against what the police were doing. So he was in one cell and I was in the next. So I'm hearing this, oh, you know, I could hear him, you know, copping these massive big punches and what have you. So even between the lock-up cell and the prison, you know, he'd sort of, so in the car on the way to the prison, you go, "Don't say anything." So we get to the prison and they put us in this prison. But I got along quite well. They probably thought I was just like one of them. But I was, you know, talking about Krishna and things like that. Of course, you know, they'd taken our wigs off and everything like that. So then we got our one phone call, and I rang Ramaswamy, who was the temple president up in Sydney, and he got us bailed out. And we got a lawyer, and when we went to court, now this, we got charged with obstructing pedestrians on the footpath, because you have to walk along the footpath with your boxes to get into the shop, so that was obstructing pedestrians. Anyone else can walk on the footpath, but not a Hare Krishna. There was a couple of other things. And even though all the charges were preposterous, they were upheld by the judge, and we were convicted and fined. And on top of being convicted and fined, they stole our money. All the money, all the Sankirtan money, they took our money and our wigs. And my new week, like this. So, according to society, you know, that was pious. What people have no idea. People have no idea these days, you know, what is pious and what is impious. Therefore, they give up and they say to be like an animal is pious. They don't have all the problems we have, they must be better than us. You know, here we are, we're human beings, and we have made a mess of everything. Why can't we be just like the animals? Do we see them, spending so much time in court cases and locking each other up in jails? And very, very simple. So, you know, people... this wedding I've got later. So people tend to just give up on the whole thing and take animal life, as it describes here, as something pious. But it describes the human beings who act like animals with the idea that one should not feel any guilt but should do whatever one likes will certainly take birth as animals absorbed in ignorance. So the problem is that when the government and society in general makes you feel guilty about something which is perhaps quite good, then you get the sense that why am I made, it is this people who make you feel guilty, that's the problem. Can you just answer that? I came in very quickly, yeah. No, it's impious, yes, though. You can lock me up after class. That's good. Just hang on. So then people mistakenly think it's not that they're legislating the wrong way and that they have no idea how to legislate, but they think, you know, the problem is if someone makes you feel guilty about something which I believe is very good. So it's this, you know, therefore we shouldn't make anyone feel guilty about anything. That's the problem. See? So in this way people become very, very confused and they just give up on trying to, you know, actually understand properly. It's very difficult in the relative world, but especially so in Kali Yuga. Because the people who are making the laws, you know, they're the people who, you know, they're people who like to make huge profits from intoxication, slaughter of animals, war, you know, and you know, they like to make huge profit by selling all sorts of non-essentials, and in order to get people to buy them, they will, you know, advertise with, you know, sexual advertisement. Even, you know, today, everything is advertised sexually. You know, you go to buy a block of soap, and think, what the hell has that got to do with sex? But somehow they'll find a way. You know, a pair of shoes, a pair of socks, anything. You know, somehow or another, you know, they've got some, you know, sexual connotation. So the people who are making the laws are these sort of rogues. And if you say, this is why, you know, in one sense, you know, the Hare Krishna movement can be perceived as somewhat of a threat. The Hare Krishna movement is, you know, saying that people should live peacefully and the animals should also live peacefully, and that there should not be unnecessary slaughter of animals. Children within the womb of the mother should be protected. So although these things are not outrageous desires, but they're considered to be a great threat to society if you say those things. That is the nature. So it's very, very difficult in Kali Yuga. Ordinarily, even in Vedic times, the natural inclination, the natural process would be actually to take up where is absolute good and where is, so it's described here in the it should be understood, however, that Krishna consciousness is absolutely good because it involves complete obedience to the absolute truth, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, whose goodness is eternal and absolute. Those who are inclined to study material piety and sin ultimately experience frustration due to the relativity and variability of the subject matter. One should therefore come to the transcendental platform of Krishna consciousness, which is valid and perfect in all circumstances. So that's the beauty of Krishna consciousness. That if we act for the in obedience to the Supreme Lord, then it is good for everyone. Why? Because he is all-knowing. How can anyone else know what is all good unless they know? If you perform an activity, in order for it to be good, you have to know that every person affected by that activity will benefit. And if you don't know that, I do this activity, I know how it affects him, and then it may affect, that goes on to his, like this. After about two or three people, I've just lost it. But, it just goes around the world. What goes around comes around. only if you perform an activity which is sanctioned by the Supreme Lord can we understand that something is all good, because he knows. The other day I was speaking, doing an astrology chart for this lady, and I looked at her chart and I said, well, this is your karma. And she said, yes, yeah, I've chosen this. And I said, no. our karma is awarded to us, the good and the bad, by the Supreme Lord. She said, no. When you die, whatever you think that you may have done wrong, you can choose a suitable punishment. And whatever you think you've done right, you can choose a suitable reward. Which is, it sounds funny, but it's a very common philosophy. It's very common for people to say that they choose their birth. Oh, I chose, I'm suffering now, but I've chosen this, I always like to feel that they're in control, even though they're not. And I said to her, how can you possibly make that choice? Only the Supreme Lord can make that choice, because in order for you to, one, you have to know every single person, every single creature that you have created some problem for, and exactly to the degree of problem, right? You have to understand that. And similarly, for every single creature, the degree of good that you've done. And then you have to choose the exact second to take birth in the exact place, then perform activities that will, suitably give the proper reaction to all of that for hundreds and hundreds of lifetimes, because not all of it can be done in one lifetime. She said, yes, that is what that is what I do. So, but, and she was quite, just straight-faced about it. Like, I'm just, are you kidding me? You're joking, right? There's a hidden camera somewhere. This is dead serious. And I tried to explain it. And she looked at me as if, what are you saying? You're a crazy person. Like, I was the crazy person. And, she was representing normal society. So, But actually, in order to come to the platform of absolute good, one does have to be obedient to the Supreme Lord, because only He knows that a certain activity has a certain, you know, overall benefit for all people, for all time. And without serving the Supreme Lord, there is no other way that that benefit can be achieved. So I'll leave it there. If anyone has any comments or questions.
One comment about Mahatma Gandhi. He was so tolerant that he put aside, if somebody hits you in one cheek, give the other cheek also, hit me again.
Mahatma Gandhi?
Mahatma Gandhi. Because the situation was so bad, the Britishers did not leave India. So he had to start quick movement, quick India. And all sorts of fasting, you know, so that they somehow understand their
position. Yeah.
So sometimes they were very atrocious.
Yes.
In 1857, they killed so many people just mercilessly.
Yes.
And killed.
Unfortunately, his activities of non-violence are just as atrocious and just as violent. Once Srila Prabhupada was invited to speak at a meeting, you know, a Gandhian meeting, and Srila Prabhupada said, you know, what can I say? You know, Gandhi has misinterpreted the teachings of God, and by in that way he's paving the way to hell for everyone. And this is the greatest violence. You know, if you destroy someone's opportunity to actually, you know, become God conscious, that's their only hope. Our only hope of actually being situated in goodness and happiness is to actually be situated in God consciousness. And if you divert people away from that, you're guaranteeing them, you know, that they'll rot in hell life after life. How many times will they be killed, slaughtered by the material energy? It is the greatest violence.
But you know one thing? When he was killed by Narottam Godse,
yeah,
he said, Hare Rama, again.
So that is the proof.
Yeah. He was a very religious man.
Even that, you know, that you know, that he said, you know, Ram in the time of death. Srila Prabhupada commented even on that sort of chanting, you know, that certainly there's some benefit there, but Gandhi said that I actually do not believe that such a person as Krishna ever existed. He actually doubted the existence of Ram and Krishna as persons. And therefore Srila Prabhupada, you know, wasn't particularly impressed the fact that he chanted Ram at the time of death, considering he didn't consider Ram to actually exist properly.
But then Lord Krishna says in 8th chapter, if you remember me, I did ask him.
There's some benefit, but we shouldn't overstate it. There's always a benefit, even for a sinful person, in calling out the name of the Lord, there's no doubt. That is because the Lord is all good. But accordingly, just like those on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, many of them returned to Vaikuntha. And attained liberation, but others, according to you know, their level of faith and devotion to Krishna, they attained various different levels of benefit on that battlefield of Kurukshetra. Not that they all just attained the same benefit, even though Krishna was personally present there. So similarly, you know, people may chant at the time of death, and according to, you know, their particular relationship with the Lord, they're certainly always benefited, but it's graded. And just like the demons, you know, demons, they also somehow, that if they're able to remember the Lord at the time of death, then some of them attain, you know, salvation, or you know, merging with the Brahman in one sense. But, you know, to the devotees, that is worse than hell. They'd rather go to hell and remember and serve Krishna. All glory to the Prabhupada.